Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined by Zwei Kwok, who is a leading expert on integrating neuroscience and mindfulness into leadership development. And today we're going to be talking about a journey that we can make between what Zwei calls Brain 1.0 towards Brain 2.0 and then Brain 3.0. And Brain 3.0 is where we can begin to access our inner sage. And Zwei will talk about her own journey, her own spiritual journey, and some of the mystical insights she encountered and how that led her to develop a body of work around accessing collective consciousness or source and the importance of us accessing Brain 3.0 in order to do so. I think it's a really beautiful map that I think fits in with a lot of things Coaches Rising really cares about as well. So we'll talk about some of the main moves we can make that will shift us out of a reactive, dysregulated Brain 1.0 and 2.0 into Brain 3.0. And what are some of the signs that we are in those different modes of brains? And what are some of the signs that we're accessing a conscious co-creation with others in Brain 3.0? So it's a really fascinating conversation. A few more things to say about Zwei. Her book, Calm Clarity, How to Use Science to Rewire Your Brain for Greater Wisdom, Fulfillment, and Joy, was one of Fast Company's best business books of 2018. And she is doing great work through her Calm Clarity programs in her local Philadelphia communities and in the US and beyond. And with all that said, let's dive in. Here is the podcast with Zwei Kwok. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. Zwei, it's great to be with you today. And so, yeah, I think we're going to have a really inspiring conversation here. Could you actually tell us, I know you've been on quite a journey yourself in terms of your worldview. And I was wondering if you could tell us about how you see the world differently these days. We're going to be exploring your work with Calm Clarity and this beautiful video you showed with me. We can link to that in the show notes. But could you just tell us a little bit about this change in worldview that you've been through and what led you to that in your life?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And it's an honor to be on this podcast with you. So thank you for inviting me. So I'm not sure where to begin since you said the change in worldview from what date. I will say that I've had a pretty amazing life and feels like I've lived maybe three or four lifetimes in one, you know, starting off as someone who was born in Vietnam, the aftermath of the war, and then came over as a baby and grew up in inner city Philadelphia and dealing with the horrific experiences of gun violence and seeing drugs all over me. I mean, all over the inner city and dealing with that type of despair, right? And yet pushing through, wanting to make a difference, getting myself to Harvard College only to fall apart there because I didn't have social support. And it was the first time I saw what a difference in quality of life existed between the two ends of the socioeconomic spectrum. And that meta that existential crisis, there was no one to help me deal with that and who I wanted to be and how would I relate to systems of power. Was my goal to assimilate and become rich, you know, and climb the social ladder, or did I have another purpose in life, right? And what drove me to get to Harvard was this idea that I would one day come back and make a difference. And yet there I was, unable to figure out my path forward, you know, fell into depression and didn't know how someone like me could even make a difference. And so as I pulled myself back together, I turned to neuroscience and realized how much trauma had changed my brain, and that the only hope of reclaiming my life and not falling apart was to try to understand what made my brain different and how could I now even compete at the level of performance that Harvard asked of people, right? How could I even run that race? And with peers who came from some of the most wealthy, resourced families in the world, right? And so I had to change and reframe the way I looked at myself and give myself so much more compassion in order to make up the difference, you could say. And all the love that I needed from the world that my parents couldn't give me, all the support that my friends couldn't give me because they didn't understand my story and I didn't know how to share it with them. I had to learn to give myself, right? And through firing and wiring different neural pathways, I learned to compensate for the brain that I had and help it perform and do all the work that my peers were doing, right? And from there, I went into management consulting. And I thought my job was just to become financially independent and secure, right? And then by my early 30s, I'd done that. I went to Wharton, got an MBA, got into private equity and social impact investments. And finally, I was like, what am I waiting for? Do I stay and become like the MDs around me, who many of whom were just toxic to be around? Or do I have the courage to walk away from this? And it was really hard, but sometimes life gives you a path that pushes you out of your comfort zone. And I was working for this social impact investor, this billionaire who was just really toxic to be around. And it was very easy to walk away from that job, you know, and I was in Singapore. And then I was like, well, what do I do with this year that I have, you know, that I'm not going to be working? Do I find a new job, or do I explore my roots and give myself a vacation, a sabbatical? And so that was the end of 2011. And then as 2012 started, I went to New Zealand with friends. We're hiking the Rupern Track, and it was stunning. It was so beautiful. And I saw how happy the hiking guides were. And I was like, why would I choose? Now that I know life could be like this, why would I choose to go back to a toxic finance career? And why can't I have more of the sense of well-being in my life? It's a choice. I have to give myself permission to understand, why do I drive myself to suffer when I don't have to? right? Because of this fear of being poor again, right? Having been a refugee, I can give myself permission to change, these belief systems to create security, right? And so then I was like, okay, when I came back, I finally decided. I still had interviews with like GIC and that I went through with, but my heart wasn't in it. And then I decided I should just take the year off. So I went to Burma and walked through like all these ancient temples in Bagan and in this other region. And then I booked myself a one-way ticket to Dharamsala to understand what meditation is. You know, why did the Buddha decide to teach all these things? My parents and my ancestors were Buddhists, but they don't understand the teachings. No one could ever explain it to me. And yet this spiritual path grew to billions of people. Like, maybe it's time to see what it could teach me when I'm soul searching. Maybe it can help me soul search and find a new purpose. And there's this intriguing idea of right livelihood. And so I was like, maybe I should find out what right livelihood looks like, right? I mean, I was doing social impact investment, but it didn't feel the way it was being done, like right livelihood. And so I went there, and to my surprise, right, I started having mystical experiences after these practices, feeling bliss, feeling this connection, this oneness with all beings. And I was like, what? You know, this, like, I'm a hardcore Wharton MBA finance person. How did I experience this? Not having any spiritual practice or inclinations before it. But then I realized, because of my love of neuroscience, there's a way to explain what's happening, right? And it was extremely healing. I got myself out of my daily routine and created a container for neuroplasticity in a way that I'd never experienced before, when all these different systems kicked in that I didn't really develop well. But as I developed them through these meditation practices, I was harnessing the benefits of experiencing a state of physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual well-being, alignment, and integration, right? In a matter of months. And I was just really blown away that that was even possible. And so then the challenge when I came back to the United States was, what do I share? How do I make a difference now that I'm back in inner city Philadelphia? And it became clear that the school district had a huge deficit, maybe $300 million. And they were just cutting staff and laying off guidance counselors. And that hurt me, like it broke my heart. And so I listened to that and began building the Calm Clarity program, because I realized maybe what I can share is the way I navigated a broken system without letting it break me. So maybe if I started sharing how the brain works and how you can counter the effects of trauma and marginalization and being disadvantaged, these kids would have a chance, a better chance than they've ever had before. And so we started testing the programs in public high schools, and the students were changing. You know, the ones who participated in the pilot, the teachers were changing. There was a pilot we ran in West Philadelphia, where it was a summer program where these students from all different high schools came, and they were ready to fight each other, right? Because they didn't know each other, they just looked different at each other, and people were ready to blow up and vent their anger because they were just so angry. And even the security guard was angry, and you could hear her shouting down the hall at all the students. And because we moved the pilot to Penn's campus, because the rooms weren't big enough at the high school, we moved it to Penn's campus because a part of Penn was sponsoring it. We invited the security guard to sit in on the class. And then she changed. She wrote in her feedback that she doesn't yell at her students or at her grandkids anymore. Like, she's Zen now. And she's even teaching her own grandchildren how to meditate, right? Because we showed people how their brain works. And the key was to recognize, and I call it the Calm Clarity Framework, but you know, I don't know what the name for it is, in terms of being able to just describe it for people, that all of us are moving between three primary patterns of brain activation. That when we're triggered by trauma, or we go into a freeze, flee, fight, flight reaction, that state of self-preservation, I just call brain 1.0. It's primal, it's human. If you live in the inner city and you hear guns, you go into brain 1.0. That's normal, right? Someone aims a gun at you or bullies you, you go into brain 1.0. Own it. It's okay. But then how do we not stay there and get stuck there, right? And too many people don't know how to cope with it. So they use dopamine, their dopamine system. They chase dopamine hits to feel good and make bad feelings go away. And so you start using drugs, self-medicating, numbing, playing video games, binging, all of that. Or in my case, overachieving, right? Using achievement to compensate for being devalued and marginalized and saying, I'll show you. You know, I had a chip on my shoulder. But then realizing I'm not really dealing with the pain, right? And to really feel aligned and integrated, you have to build what I call Brain 3.0. And these are the systems that give you executive functioning, emotional intelligence that allow you to bring your greatest qualities and gifts to the world around you to make a positive impact. But it comes from building four important neural systems, your attention system. Can you see the quality of your attention? Whether you can actually direct and guide it, or does it get hijacked by Brain 1.0 towards something that is threatening to you, or by Brain 2.0 towards some way to escape, right? You make it all or nothing. You become rigid about, I need this to be happy. You know, it can create OCD issues, right? Compulsions. Can you be resilient? Are you aware of your body battery? What it feels like when you become drained and tired, that you need to practice self-care, that you need social support, right? Are you taking care of yourself? Then there's the meta-awareness system. Are you aware of your stories and how your stories might be holding you back or causing you to transmit your own wounds to other people so you don't have an accurate view of what's really happening, right? And then the last system is your connection system. Can you open your heart and mind to connect with another human being, or are you contracted? Are you pulling back because you feel threatened and afraid, right? And how much of that fear is within you, and how much are you actually in danger, right? And it takes time to unpack and build these systems to the point where you can be aligned and integrated, right? And so over the course of the last dozen years or so, we've just been continuously running programs, seeing their impact and tweaking it to make the neuroscience more clear, to make the user manual more usable, right? And I feel like now we're at a point where, like, it's much more crystallized than when I first started speaking to Coaches Rising in 2020. And the pandemic, I think, basically highlighted to me the degree to which I was still in pain. And I needed to heal all the parts of me that was hurting so that I could get more aligned, more whole, to be able to transmit alignment and wholeness rather than transmitting my own pain, my own insecurities, right? Mm-hmm. So it forced me to take time off and eventually take a sabbatical so that I wasn't sacrificing myself in order to support others, if that makes sense.
It's a beautiful story, journey you've been on. And there's so many questions I could ask. I want to speak more about the work you've been doing with Calm Clarity and that crystallization at some point. But what I hear in your story, and when you shared this video that we'll start to unpack as well, it really spoke to me of like maybe an invitation being made to us collectively right now to go on our own healing journey and to, to recognize when we're getting caught in Brain 1.0 and 2.0, as you described them, and the possibility to kind of collaborate and interact in Brain 3.0. And so what I want to ask you about is, you know, if I come back to that question around worldview, because it, you know, just so far based on what you're saying, it's like, you know, neuroscience, like if I back up a little bit, it seems like if I look around in the world, you know, we can easily point to a lot of crises or challenges we're facing. But if you look a little bit more around, it also seems like there's, a lot of people now orienting towards, spirituality and like non-materialist or post-materialist worldviews. And so neuroscience could be co-opted into a materialist worldview, you know, which basically is just seeing every the material reality is the only reality that exists. But, you know, if you think about things like the telepathy tapes, which I don't know if you know about that, but it's about these non-speaking autistic children who are able to, they're telepathic, and much more than that, they're connecting with this field of intelligence they call God, a lot of them. It's fascinating. My question is, like, have you found your own worldview shifting along those lines? We could start to talk about the video and some of the ideas you were sharing there. Yeah.
That's a good question. I think part of what crystallized for me was the courage to share what I see. I think when I first got back from India, I felt pressure. I mean, we were literally going through slides, you know, with the director of this program at Penn that was running after school programs where we were piloting the Tom Clary program that summer. And she said, because of grant funding, you have to take out any quotations of something religious. So anytime I quoted Jesus or the Bible, we had to take it out or change it to ancient proverb, right? And I internalized that as it's going to be safer to just make it a strictly science program. And as we got invited to give keynotes and workshops, you know, in the corporate world, it just seemed it was safer to keep it strictly neuroscience. But now with all the disarray and chaos in the world, right? I think we need to be spiritually anchored, and we don't understand enough about who we are to spiritually anchor ourselves, right? And so for me, neuroscience is a Rosetta Stone for understanding what enables human beings to really flourish, to genuinely flourish and thrive, and what causes us to suffer and languish, right? And there are a few things that are universal, though there is neurodiversity and everyone experiences their or develops their brain in slightly different ways. But there are some general trends, you could say, about what having a human brain is like, right? And how it grows and develops over time. And the Connectome Project is studying all of that. And it's beautiful and it's amazing. And I think, you know, there are science centers like the Greater Good Science Center at Berkeley and others that are studying this. Right? What really does enable us to thrive? Altruism does help us thrive. Why did we evolve to be altruistic? Why did we evolve to be connected in community? And there's this wonderful book called Social by Matthew Lieberman, which I have behind me somewhere, that explains that our default mode network, you know, which a lot of people think of as this annoying thing to have, is actually a miracle of evolution, because it allows us to live in societies, to keep track of who's dating who, who's not happy with who can't sit next to who, you know, at a wedding or a party. It allows us to have this rich social life. And the size of the brain of mammals correlates to the size of our tribes. Human beings have the largest tribes, right, compared to all the other animals. And that's part of the reason why we have the largest frontal lobe. And our default mode network is so actively keeping track of our social world and where we stand in the hierarchy, right? Now, some of the challenges is that our society, our cultures, right, have not been healing trauma or marginalization or the genocides that happened in the past even, right? We've just moved on with it and survived. And all that internalized pain, you know, have caused us to create a society that's Darwinian, right? And that's not even what Darwin intended, you know, because he believed in altruism and community being the highest state for human beings, not a state of dog-eat-dog fighting, right? Not a rat race. And so we've constructed this capitalistic society, right? Where we create artificial scarcity to get rich. Right. So in the finance world, arbitrage, you see an opportunity for arbitrage and you make money. Right. That's how most financiers make money. And they create artificial scarcity in order to arbitrage it. Right. It works. But is it ethical, right? And does it also this getting creating profit through extraction and exploitation, right? It devalues the human experience. And so across the world, people are in pain because they're being devalued. They're treated as labor, as resources, and not as spiritual beings, and their potential is never realized. So we all go to work and we feel underutilized and we don't feel very engaged, right? And so the truth is, when you search in your heart, when you go out to nature, right, there's more to us than capitalism could ever extract, right? There's this richness, this essence, right? And when I think of this great scientist of our day, they all described downloading the breakthroughs, you know, in a dream, in the shower, you know, on a walk, right? It just hit them, this eureka moment, these epiphanies. Where is it coming from, right? And the musicians describe it. It's like the music has its own essence, and it was just given to me to create a song, you know, but that song exists in another plane. I just got to be the one to give birth to it in this world and take credit for it, you know? And so conscious co-creation, right, is a mystery. And the things that we celebrate, human genius, may actually be a mystical experience. Where people like Einstein, the Beatles, you know, they connect it to their higher selves, to source, and they download it, some gift to give the human, to give humanity, right? And we knew right away it was precious, and we celebrated it. Now, we don't really create enough situations for people to have those epiphanies, to have those breakthroughs that could completely change our lives and elevate quality of life, right? And so as we kind of spiral downward through capitalism, through this exploitative form of capitalism, right, then people are being treated as cogs. They don't get to have that spiritual download, right, that can solve climate change. And so we're kind of utilizing and devaluing what it means to be human, right? And on treating each other, you know, as labor through transactions rather than as divine beings, right? And so when I try to make sense of all of this, you know, like it does feel like an interesting dance. How do you dance with the universe and dance with all of these stories that people get entangled into? What makes us all believe it has to be this way, that this is the way life is, that you have to give in to a system that extracts? Is there a way to reinvent capitalism? If we were all in Brain 3.0 and we were to develop an economic system that supports thriving, right, that supports human beings to be creative, to be innovative, we wouldn't choose this current system. We would choose a different system, right? But because their powers, people with a lot of power who benefit in Brain 2.0, right, from keeping us all in Brain 2.0 and 1.0, you know, they hold us back, but we also give them the power to hold us back. When do we decide we won't give the system power?
Yeah, it's beautiful. And as you know, as you're speaking, I can certainly see this. I'm sure the listeners too, that, you know, in a way, like our current system seems to be going in that direction even more, you know, with kind of populism and social media polarization, you know, hijacking attention and pulling us away from accessing our own lived thriving and connection to something greater than ourselves. So I can really feel how we were being kind of under optimized. Maybe that even that word optimization is problematic here because it's part of the language of that whole system of you know, being cogs in machines and stuff. So could you tell us a little bit about, you know, There's this slide in the video that you presented where you're actually kind of articulating the journey of how we could even begin to connect to a collective consciousness, and how Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0 takes us out of that. And just before you say that, I just want to reflect on my experience as someone who, as we were checking in before, it's like I can feel my own vulnerability around these topics because I grew up in a really secular, materialist community society. And so and somehow I found myself as a very spiritually oriented person and very open-minded, and also had mystical experiences as a younger person and older person too, as I've grown. And yet, it was so interesting. I mentioned the telepathy tapes. Like, what I found interesting about that, apart from the incredible story that's told about these children and what they're talking about, and that they're actually telepathic. They're meeting each other in a kind of subtle space, altogether a non-physical space, but that they're kind of like downloading languages. Even one of them starts being able to write in Egyptian hieroglyphics. So, and they're talking, well, I do this because we just go to the source. So my point is that it took me listening to that to even encounter some of the more ingrained, subtle layers of the materialistic worldview in me. That even though I've been on these journeys and had mystical experiences, I encounter my own doubt about there being something like an intelligent, benevolent field within that we're actually part of. And maybe some level of skepticism is healthy, because direct experience is the biggest transformer. That's important. But I just wanted to share a little bit about where I was coming from in this conversation, and then we can talk about the slide as well as you share. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that we are social creatures. Like I said, our default mode network is attuned to the environment around us, and one of its jobs is to help us assimilate and conform and fit into the cultures that we were born into so we wouldn't be ostracized, right? And us being cast out, being exiled from your tribe was a very painful experience that often led to death, right? For our human ancestors way back in the day. These days we can get by, right? But in the old days we couldn't. And I think it's really important to ask these questions and know that we don't have enough scientific evidence one way or another, right? So we are talking about theories and hypotheses and preliminary evidence, right? That shows there's something that it's not being explained by the major religions of today, right? Like I went through and searched through Buddhism and Hinduism, and I don't think their views explain the data that I've encountered either, right? And so we have these systems of knowledge that are passed from generation to generation, but not vetted. And what I see is like, what if we could treat all of this as pieces of a big cosmic jigsaw puzzle. And we just put all the pieces together, see where they fit, and maybe pieces are missing that would actually integrate them and help us see how they connect to each other, right? And at some level, all of them could be true. And at some level, all of them are still missing, like a bigger picture view, right? There are pieces that are still missing. And I'd like to be humble enough to say that I don't have all the pieces either, right? But one of the things I learned when I got to travel through Ephesus, which is extraordinary, the ancient city of Troy, and the ruins are still there in Turkey, I believe on the East Coast, where people look at the old library, and it's an amazing place. And at that time, there were Stoics. Right, like Epictetus, and they believed that the language they used was logos to describe God, right? And logos is kind of, if you try to translate it, it's kind of like the creative intelligence, the creative rational essence of the universe that gives us the laws of nature. By discerning how logos manifests in nature, the ancient Greek philosophers discovered pi, the Pythagorean theorem, how to create a, how to measure the circumference of a circle. You know, like they measured the circumference of the earth. They knew it was round, right? I mean, their ability to tune in using logos, capital, I mean, there's capital logos for the divine greater being, and like lowercase logos for the way it we have it in ourselves. And when we connect to our internal logos, right, that faculty within us, we can discern and download from the cosmic logos these discoveries. And so Pythagoras and these other mathematicians were meditating to see the forms that are hidden in nature. And that's how they discovered them, right? It is a mystical experience to be a Greek philosopher and deconstruct or decode nature, right? And maybe that's how the Fibonacci sequence was downloaded or two. And I remember seeing a film about a great Indian mathematician who I think was born in poverty, but was brought to England because he was so brilliant. I didn't see the whole thing, but I believe the beginning of it, he would spend his time in temples. I forget if it was the Lakshmi temple or a different goddess, and download mathematical formulas from spending time contemplating the magic of the cosmos through this goddess, right, through his form of worshiping. And so I think we can't say what is or isn't true, you know, but we can say there are these connections, there are these downloads that happen. How do we create the causes and conditions to allow more of this magic to unfold? Because this is what moves the humanity forward, these discoveries. This is what leads us to flourish, right? And the way we create profit in Brain 2.0 is going to lead to the destruction of resources, right? To unstable climate, to natural disasters. We're getting a lot of feedback from nature that trying to create profit through Brain 2.0 is actually creating harm. But we can create value through Brain 3.0 by downloading from source in ways that move us forward. We have a choice to develop that faculty if we were willing to put more money and dollars there instead of on the extraction of resources. Right.
In a way, we've been talking about this, but what is for you, what's been in your experience? And I know you're doing this with your board as well. What helps you to access Brain 3.0 and you know, kind of start to receive guidance? What gets in the way of that?
That's a good question. So what we've developed as training, we call it the Lead in Alignment and Wholeness Program. And it begins with this phase we call the Foundation Program, where you build these four neural systems that I described. So you build your attention system so you can see when Brain 1.0 or 2.0 are distracting you, right? You build your resilience system so you can manage your triggers and hold space for each other. You build your meta-awareness system so we can start to see each other's stories and help mirror back stories so that we can assess what level of consciousness those stories are coming from. And then we build up the connection system. So we open our hearts, we open our minds, so we're in a better state to download, right? Now, not everyone can just do this off the streets, right? Like it takes effort and conscious intention to work together to create this container and support each other to be vulnerable and oftentimes heal parts of us that we've been hiding or covering, right? So that we can be more aligned and whole with each other, right? It takes trust. So like this board has been working together on this for a long time. We meet on a weekly basis to create this container and create this trust. And this then allows our what I call the inner sage, which is when your default mode network is in Brain 3.0 and connecting to source consciousness to give us guidance, right? For our inner sages to have a conversation that welcomes also when we start having stories come up in Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0. And so I think it might be helpful to give a metaphor here, where what I've realized is that all human beings, our nervous systems might be part of what I would call a biotransmission system, right? Our nervous system help us sense the fields around us, right? And tune into the fields. And that's default mode network. You can think of it like a tuner for a radio station. Whatever your inner narrator is saying to you, think of it like a radio. If it's telling you stories of fear, it's tuning into the Brain 1.0 part of the spectrum, right? If it's telling you stories of you need to do this, this, and this, planning, execution, taking things for your own interest, winning. And I had to admit, like when the Eagles won the Super Bowl, I was there, you know, in Brain 2.0, celebrating with the rest of the people, just observing it and just knowing it's a game, right? Not taking it too seriously. But you're tuning into that part of the spectrum, right? The quest for dominance and winning and things like that, when you're the hero of the journey and everyone else is an enemy who's in your way or an obstacle, you can tell the energy of that story. And then when your default mode network is connecting to a higher level of consciousness, there is no drama. There is this sense of curiosity, compassion, the sense of insight or wisdom, looking at what is going on without becoming attached, without feeling that there's something wrong with you or there's something wrong with everyone. It's just a process of unfolding, a process of conscious co-creation happening, where most of humanity isn't yet conscious enough to co-create, flourishing together. As long as we're in Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0, it's a state of mindlessness in which these stories prompt us to get to put a lot of more energy into stories of scarcity, stories of survival. The more we energize that it's a dog-eat-dog world, the more we co-create a dog-eat-dog world inadvertently, right? And it's us stepping back and saying, what are my stories about life? Do I really want to co-create that version of life, right? Is there a different version of how I interact with the world that I would rather energize, right? And I get to now redirect my time, my attention, my energy, and my resources towards manifesting this vision of the world in Brain 3.0 rather than one that's in Brain 2.0 or 1.0, right? And so we have 7 billion human beings across the planet, all in different stages of evolution, and all co-creating either unconsciously in 1.0 or 2.0, or consciously in Brain 3.0. And most people are a mix. Sometimes they're consciously co-creating in Brain 3.0, and a lot of times we're not aware, where we're unconsciously adding to the drama in 1.0 and 2.0, right? And so the way coaching comes in, and my hope, you know, as we clarify and crystallize the way our user manual for steering brain development, that more and more coaches can use it to clarify their own stories, right? To discern when they're energizing stories of entanglement in Brain 1.0 and 2.0, and when they can free themselves from that entanglement in the stories that elevate us into Brain 3.0, right? And the difference is something you can sense in your body. Stories that energize and amplify Brain 1.0 cause our body to have a freeze, flee, fight, fight, fawn type of reaction. We shrink, we get smaller, right? We get tight. Stories in Brain 2.0 make us feel restless and impatient, like we got to do something, right? And we're short term, we're not long term. The stories of Brain 3.0, they open us up to eternity, right? You start to see time and space are illusions. and something beautiful is emerging through us. Sometimes we just have to get out of the way by not creating more drama and bring 1.0 and 2.0 and this and hold space for what is emerging. And it's not about striving. It's not about conquest. It's not about achievement. It's about allowing ourselves to be channels for this higher consciousness. I call it the higher self, who is beyond the capacity of the human brain to fully understand. This higher self evolves somehow by incarnating through us into human bodies to physically experience life, to physically co-create with arms, hands, feet, you know, to build things, to experience itself as a creator, right? To even give birth, right? To become parents. Whatever it is, all human beings have value to this higher being. It chose to co-create this world, to experience life as human beings through us. And we just have to see that in each other. And when we can see that we're all emanations of source consciousness, the stories we tell up about each other don't have to be so dark. Does that resonate?
Yeah, it does resonate. I mean, first of all, you know, what I really am tracking as you talk is that I really resonate with the view, you know, like I can see when I collapse into I can feel it when I collapse into a free state. And, you know, over the years, I've gotten more and more aware of that. And the more inner work I've done, the less that collapse has happened as well. And I can feel that kind of brain 2.0 comparative restless consciousness. You know, it's very easy to access that, enter that space in these times, it feels like, because that feels like, particularly if you go on the look on the news and social media, it seems to feed that very easily. And I really track how, for example, the manifestation of Coaches Rising has come through that brain 3.0, where it's like, you know, I remember writing the manifesto for Coaches Rising, which I wrote that in 2009. And then I reread it about a year ago, and I was like, that's just, it's perfect still, you know, it's very short. It's not, so calling it a manifesto is a bit generous, but, and I remember just sitting down and writing it, you know, it's like, it just came through me like you're describing. So I hold in high value now awareness of when I'm collaborating with people inside of that vibratory experience of inspiration and wholeness that you describe so beautifully. It's like you can just feel it, you know, and there's a kind of emergent quality to it, and, you know, a kind of eros, and, you know, almost like you're tapping into the evolutionary current that wants to emerge through people. It's like, it's not only fruitful, it's like inherently fulfilling as a practice, you know. And so it's encouraging to see more and more people around the world, I think, tap, you know, being enthusiastic about that. What I've found useful through interaction with one of my teachers is this idea that like, you know, first, everything's happening for me, you know, in a sense that it's like everything's an invitation into my own expansion. You know, and in a sense, the world is subjective, you know, so that stops me from getting into this kind of make wrong experience where I'm just judging everything and everyone for making me feel a certain way. But that's happening on a gross level, but it's also happening on these very subtle levels where I'm, and it's taking me out of that brain 3.0 that you're describing when I do that. And so life is, if I hold that everything's happening for my own expansion, that allows me to meet my experience in a very beautiful way. Like, it's not easy, but it's like, suddenly I can, there's a fuel for kind of being present to life. And, you know, the vulnerable thing to share is, you know, I find myself becoming increasingly open to the idea that this is not the first time round for us, you know, that like, yeah, And that we're here to learn something. You know, we chose to be here to learn something. And there's kind of books written on this that are quite convincing, where they've tracked young children who've spoken about previous lives and been able to identify their stories through what they share in detail, you know, and that's
Yeah, it's
vulnerable to
a
share because of, yeah, that's not a commonly held worldview in our times. So
well, it's
there's a
actually
few
more
things that
common
come
than
up.
you think, because more than a billion people, maybe 2 billion people, believe in reincarnation. And
Right,
it's
fair
where you
enough.
grew up, it's not dominant, right? But I will say that, you know, this is a big cosmic mystery, and I think it's important to be humble and see where the data, the evidence, you know, points, right? And I don't have enough evidence to say that anyone understands or has an accurate description of how reincarnation works, right? The Buddhist perspective may not be accurate. The Hindu perspective may not be accurate. I mean, if you think about recycling, right? When you throw a plastic bottle into the recycling bin and it comes back as a rug, you can't say the entire bottle went into the rug, right? Like, thousands of bottles went into that rug, and parts of the bottle that you threw in there became something else too, right? There's this, and I don't know how to describe it except through the metaphor of recycling, right? As we go back into the source, all of the richness of our experience is distributed into this ocean of energy, and how it comes back again, whether it's still Joel Monk or not. Who can say, you know, that thing about Theseus's ark, right? Once you replace it and repair it, is it still Theseus's ark? You know, I think it's a mystery, and no religion actually understands it. And all we know, we collect evidence, is that there are psychic experiences, there are psychic phenomena that can't be explained, right? There are downloads and transmissions that happen. If we could collect that data in a neutral, objective way, we would see that human beings have spiritual abilities naturally, regardless of what religion we practice, whether we even practice a religion, right? And then, if you like, for instance, I'm going to go to Guatemala with John Perkins to understand Mayan shamanism and Mayan spiritual culture and practices. As we look at more and more of these indigenous communities and how they've preserved their traditions despite persecution, right? There's so much we can learn from traditions all over the world, right? In terms of what their ancestors saw, what the shamans currently see, that are not contaminated, you could say, by dogma that we were brainwashed in growing up, right? And by collecting this data, it's up to us to then see what the data says, right? And I think it's too early for me to make any conclusions. It's possible that it's more likely, it's more efficient that this higher being doesn't just come once in a human body, right? And there's a very big possibility that we are all emanations of source consciousness, and to a certain extent, we are all incarnations of each other.
That's beautiful. Wow. And can I ask you about, I mean, I'm touched by what you share there. You know, it's interesting that, isn't it? You know, like just to reflect on that we're all emanations of each other. How did you phrase it exactly again?
Well, that we're all emanations of source consciousness.
All emanations of source consciousness. Just the fact that that touches something inside of me is, I'm getting very curious about that. What, you know, what is that? And what I want to ask you about is your experience of being in conscious co-creation with your board. Could you give us some, you know, some insights into how what's that like for you and your team, and how you practice that?
Sure. Well, there are specific cycles, you could say, where like during the summer last year is when we did a strategic visioning process. And what that involved was creating a space to all tune in to what I would call like the spiritual essence of Calm Clarity. What does Calm Clarity want to bring into the world? Why does it exist? How has it called us to it? You know, what do we have that helps manifest Calm Clarity's vision and mission, right? And then we had a number of questions, and we actually used AI, you know, which is ironic to some people, but we created a form where all of us went through an exercise of connecting to Calm Clarity, like meditating. And then as we went through this list of questions, we entered our questions into the form. And then one of the board members is a technology person who's having fun with AI. He's on like this historically Black colleges committee to look at how to present AI to create economic development in Black communities, right? And so he fed it into the engine and it summarized what everyone said, you know, and it sounded really wise. And it was really beautiful what came back. And so it was a fun process of dancing with the universe and new technologies and just being open to what other people had to share and what the unity of all these perspectives, how it came together. Right. And so we've got clarity on what our segments were. You know, how do we discern what's on mission and what's not? Right. How do we better allocate resources to the work that we're doing? Right. What do we prioritize and what do we have to put in the back burner? Because we can't do everything. Right. And so it helped us to make important decisions as we move forward, and also to have this courage to talk about things that, you know, because it felt unsafe, I didn't want to talk about when I first came back from Asia.
And did you find in those conversations, I'm presuming there was, you know, you said you individually explored the Calm Clarity as a, you know, as an entity and what that wanted. Did you come together collectively to then kind of explore and share? And did you experience in that there was an experience of being in conscious co-creation?
Yeah. So Henry, you know, fed it all into his AI engine and then gave us the report. And then we process and impact the report together and talk through it. And we were all just blown away, you know, by the wisdom and insight that was in what he created using technology. And so that experience that we all contributed to this report, and now it's up to us, how do we unpack it and implement it, right? And we're continuing to do that. And of course, everything requires like adjustments, right? So what the environment that we were in this past summer is no longer the environment we're in today. So how do we adapt to the current environment?
And as we come towards the end of our conversation, I don't know if there's anything we haven't spoken about that you might want to bring in. I have a question about what practices you do as well, but so I could go there. But is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is important?
Yeah, I think one of the things we're working on that I'd love to share is that we've been trying to make it more concrete through assessments, right? So we're currently pilot testing an assessment that helps people discern how Brain 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0 manifest in their everyday life. And so there are like 10 items for Brain 1.0, 10 for Brain 2.0, 10 for Brain 3.0. And the way the assessment works is it gives you all that data back to you. And so that you can reflect on what are the patterns that come up for you, and you can bring more curiosity and awareness as these things arise, what's triggering them, similar to what you said earlier. And so then you can begin to anticipate the triggers and bring more Brain 3.0 to those situations, right? And then the second assessment that we're still fine tuning, and it's part of the foundation program, part of like being an intervention rather than an assessment, is to help people see for these four systems, what are the key competencies that they enable? What does it mean to have a strong attention system or a strong resilience system, a strong meta awareness system, or a strong connection system? Right. And so we've kind of distilled five competencies for each of these. And then all of us are kind of starting from ground zero in a sense that did we build practices or habits in our day that strengthen these systems, that activate these competencies? If we did, then they're part of our autopilot. Our autopilot would naturally be able to say, oh, my attention is scattered right now. I need to take time to focus my attention or take a break or, you know, to take care of my attention system. Now, if we don't build them, then, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 is your autopilot doesn't do it, right? 5 would be you've been able to develop this, but maybe during times of stress, it still takes conscious effort to do this, like it slips away. And then when it's fully, when you're stable, it's part of your autopilot, you would do it in times of stress too, right? So it's fully anchored, like you brush your teeth when you're stressed and when you're not stressed, right? You walk, like these are things that are not disrupted by being stressed. But there are a lot of things when you're really stressed that your autopilot doesn't do because it's not ingrained enough. And that's why people drill. Right. So when you talk about practices, I think the important thing now is to be able to assess what are our strengths and where are the weaknesses, where and what do we need to do on a more regular basis to train that competency into the autopilot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Beautiful. And I, you know, just as you speak about that, I'm inspired for the day, and this is happening, I think, as well, but the day when we design our societies for that too, you know, because for example, you know, I'm trying to create a new relationship with my smartphone, which actually may mean me getting rid of it. But first of all, I'm going to see if I can get into the right relationship with it. And if that's not possible, I'll really consider getting rid of it because I feel like it hijacks my attention so much and it takes me out of, you know, it can, if I'm not careful, reading the, you know, doom scrolling, whatever, will flip me into 1.0, 2.0 brains. So I'm looking forward to the day when we start to build into our societies. And we've had this, you know, through, I think, for example, organized religions, like for their faults, I think they did have it built into them certain rituals and practices that actually did support the flourishing of people into brain 3.0 as well. So yeah, how can we build those in on a collective level to support the individual moves we
can make? I think a lot of this comes to integrating the dopamine system into brain 3.0.
Yeah, say more about that. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. So basically, when we have a dysregulated dopamine system, then it can get it. Then it starts chasing dopamine hits, like from the smartphone, like from external sources, to make bad feelings go away. So a lot of times people are on their smartphones because they're feeling bad. And they're trying to be distracted from their bad feelings, right? When you recognize, like, is that what's happening when you're on your smartphone? Like, that's the reason a lot of people smoke cigarettes, right? When you really are mindful about when are you more likely to smoke a cigarette, when you're feeling bad and you want to make the bad feeling go away, right? Like, you're just trying to get a dopamine hit. And the question then becomes, are there wholesome sources of dopamine that will be more fulfilling? Right. Mm. And so so the lead in alignment and wholeness program, there's actually three stages. So the first stage is the foundation where you begin to understand these four systems as the pillars of your ability to embody your higher self. Right. And then there's the alignment stage where you recognize there's a gap between what your autopilot does and what your higher self would want you to do. Right. And how do you close the gap? And the autopilot is a function of your social conditioning, every experience of marginalization and rejection and trauma and every negative experience you've internalized has gone into the autopilot, right? Every coping mechanism, all of that. And so when the autopilot is nourished by the higher self, then it says that bliss feels so much better than the smartphone. I will choose that bliss over this dopamine hit. And so the Buddha said, wisdom is choosing a greater happiness over a lesser one. And so when your dopamine system is aligned with your higher self, there's a sense of joy and bliss that transforms those negative feelings, that integrates those parts of you to become whole with yourself again. So they don't feel exiled and there's no need to doom scroll, right? I don't know if that's making sense. And so I remember, you know, like everybody, you know, when I was younger, recreational pot use was part of my life, right? And I remember when I went to India and I decided to, you know, you can take refuge and you can give up intoxicants. I was like, that's hard. I don't know if I can do that, right? Because that means no pot, no alcohol, none of that. But then the bliss that I experienced at Tushita was so much more fulfilling and healing than any high or buzz I ever got. And I thought, well, this is going to be easy now because I'm choosing this state of alignment and wholeness. And the parts of me that had urges for pot or alcohol, you know, they didn't go away, but they were able to say, yeah, you're right. That's so much better. You know, we don't want to distract you from that. And it was easier to be aligned when, because I knew what I was choosing. I was choosing something better.
Yeah. I totally relate to that. That was for me with, like, I wouldn't even say giving up alcohol. It was just like, drinking alcohol is like, oh, this takes me out of this feeling of well-being. Like, even, and it's not that I don't drink alcohol now, like I'll, but it's very, very rare and on a much lower level. But it was like, so first of all, it was like, oh, like hangovers are just really horrible, you know, and it doesn't take much, of course, as you get older. But then it was like, even the buzz of drinking a beer takes me out of this feeling of joy and well-being and presence that's here. And hey, I'd rather choose that. So it's just not that difficult a choice. So
yeah.
And aligning our dopamine with brain 3.0, could you just say a little bit more about how we could practice that? I get the overall kind of principle, but
I talk about optimizing for neurobiology, even though optimizing might sound too productive, right? But the way our brains work, right? We can get dopamine from awe. So going into nature to experience awe,
right?
You know, you can satisfy that. Having strong relationships with our loved ones. So your parents, your children, your siblings, taking time to heal those relationships. Right? Building a strong social support network, having friends who care about us and vice versa, right? So there are ways to build natural sources of dopamine that give us a deeper sense of fulfillment, right? And it's when those connections are not present that we reach for, I don't know what to call it, artificial dopamine, right? From food, drugs, substances, and things like that. Or from social media, right? Those are parasocial relationships. Those aren't deep friendships, right? And so as long as we understand, you know, we have to build a life where we feel meaning, the dopamine can support that sense of meaning, right? And the impact that you make in the world can give you dopamine too, right? It's not the reason why you do it, but it can give you a healthy dopamine system, right? And so I think a lot of what's happening in the world are because of trauma and disconnection and dehumanization, we don't have healthy sources of dopamine in our lives. And then we become dependent on these artificial sources. Right. And that's why there's so much addiction and codependence.
Great. That's super helpful. Zwei, this was just a really great conversation. I really appreciate just your journey and the lucidity with which you talk about these topics. So could you tell us a little bit more where people are interested, where they can find out more about what you're up to as well?
Yes, I'd love to welcome anyone who's interested in experiencing what we're talking about to go to calmclarity.org. So that's CalmClarity.org. And you can see like our Lead in Alignment and Wholeness program featured there. I think on the training page or the main page, you can get a link to the assessment. And I believe somewhere in the resources, there's a link to that video that you've been talking about that you can also share directly. I'm just excited that there are so many people who are interested in living at a higher level of consciousness. And I want to encourage as many people as possible to come together, right? And the more we build a community where we support each other, we validate each other's mystical experiences of higher consciousness, we can make it easier to open our hearts and our minds to co-creating, to consciously co-creating with source, right? And I think that's really how we rise to the challenges of our time, right? There's just so much happening that's heartbreaking, but we are still bigger than that. We can tap into an internal force, an eternal force that lives through us to meet those challenges with wisdom and compassion, insight and innovation, creativity, right? And there's so much that's still emerging, that's still unfolding. And we shouldn't diminish ourselves. We shouldn't un underestimate what human beings can do when we come together in Brain 3.0.
Yeah, beautiful. Thanks, Wei.
My pleasure.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is for me the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this, and it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper, we've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well. And I'll see you again next time.